You should call the number 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. I don't know what in why I did what I just did, but I don't know. It just seemed right at that point. Like you pledging to the radio station would be seem right at that point. Anyway, stay tuned for Resistance Radio coming up.
And welcome to Resistance Radio. I am John Kane, and again, I'm glad that you've decided to tune me in. Let me say that I know that I've talked a lot about Native people serving in non-Native institutions, whether it's military, whether it's, you know, elected office or whatever else. But a comment got made recently that said, for the first time in 230 years. Congress has full indigenous representation. Okay, so I heard that, and of course, all right, that's what we're going to say. Let me understand what they meant by that. And what was meant by that, and I think it was actually said by the congressman from Hawaii, Kai Kahele, who has Native Hawaiian ancestry. I don't know his full background. I know he's been very much in the system in terms of serving in the military. I think he was a pilot. He was a commissioned officer. I think he was actually a senator for a while, but maybe it was only state senator. But now he sits in Congress. And what he was talking about is that now there is a person of Native Hawaiian ancestry in Congress. There's also a person of Alaskan Native ancestry in Congress because of Mary Peltola, and Charisse David's of Kansas. She's Ho-Chunk, and she's in Congress. I will say that there's also three other congressmen. But the Republicans, so they almost don't count in this conversation, I guess. So, but there's basically six people of Native, some level of Native ancestry that are serving in Congress. And so the comment is that now, for the first time in American history, Congress has full indigenous representation. No, we don't. That's not the system. Let me be clear. Those folks serving in those offices, whether it's Hawaii, Alaska, or Kansas, they represent Hawaii, Alaska, and Kansas. And as far as Hawaii and Kansas are concerned, they only represent the congressional district that they were elected to. In Alaska, there's only one. The whole state is one congressional district, if I'm not mistaken. So, and they wouldn't be elected if they were only elected by Native people. And I got to tell you, even in the case of Charisse Davids, she's a congressman in Kansas, but she's Ho-Chunk from Wisconsin. So she doesn't even technically represent the Ho-Chunk. I mean, she represents Kansas. And, you know, look, there's Native people in Kansas, and don't get me wrong. And I'm not suggesting that these folks will not bring some element of concern with them to these offices for indigenous peoples. I'm not saying that. I'm not questioning that. But what I'm saying is they don't serve Native people. We didn't elect them. You know, I'm sitting here on the Cattaraugus Territory of Seneca Nation. I sure didn't elect any of these guys. So I don't feel like they are representing my interest. And to be clear, in the case of the three that I just mentioned, they're Democrats. And we can have a conversation about what that means, or if you're a Republican, what that means. So do you represent party first, or do you represent your district first? Do you represent your state, or do you represent somehow your specific ethnicity? Now, look, I get it. The level of white dominance in all areas of government and politics and corporate USA, all of it, it's disproportionate. So does a white guy who serves in Congress represent white people? He doesn't really need to, because almost all of them are white. I mean, saying that Congress is now indigenous people are fully represented now in Congress is like saying the Supreme Court is fully represented by black people now because Clarence Thomas is there. That's not the way it works. You have to know more about the individual. And like I said, Kai Kahele, he just like so many Native people, had been very indoctrinated. Military service, a commissioned officer in, I think, the Air National Guard or Air Reserves or something like that. Mary Petola, her father's white, and he was a military guy. And, I know she has Native ancestry on her mother's side. And again, I'm not questioning her level of Nativeness. But, Sharice Davids, I'm not questioning her integrity or anything else like that. But to say that because these three and the three others have a level of Native ancestry in their blood quantum, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, doesn't necessarily mean that they're representing Native interests. Look, in Hawaii in particular, I have a lot of friends in Hawaii. And most of the friends that I have in Hawaii are very pro-Hawaiian kingdom and trying to reassert their sovereignty and their independence. If you're running for, if you're serving U.S. Congress, you're not representing that in Congress, and you sure as hell weren't going to have the party endorsement. These guys represent the Democratic Party system, that apparatus, and however anybody listening to this feels about that, well, okay, and that's fine. I mean, look, I have my druthers, I guess, when it comes to most Republicans versus most Democrats. And I think for the most part, not just because of Trump, but certainly consistent with Trump, the Republicans have really allowed racism to percolate to the top. It was always there, percolate to the top and be a hallmark of their party at this point. That's not to say that there's not plenty of racism within the Democratic Party. I've talked about Kathy Hochul and her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo. Look, we've had plenty of racist behavior out of Democrats, and we always will, because we don't fit into the system. As Native people who are really trying to preserve a distinction, an autonomy, sovereignty, Native sovereignty isn't consistent with any part of the United States. It's a problem. It's glossed over. Yeah, I know there are elected officials that say, oh yeah, I know what tribal sovereignty is. You remember that classic bumbling of George Bush W saying, tribal sovereignty is sovereignty for tribes. He didn't know what the hell he was talking about. He had no idea what it meant, but he never entered into a conversation. He never had any fear of entering into a conversation that he knew nothing about. But you know what? That's true with most politicians. I think it was Anthony Scalia who said, when it comes to Native issues in the courts, we're pretty much making stuff up as we go along. Because, there's too much inconsistency, whether it's with the courts or whether it's with the law or whether it's with politics. I mean, it's too inconsistent with the stated American values. Kind of like slavery and we the people, right? I mean, yeah, there's just too much inconsistency there, and that's been our history, I applaud their success in that system, but it's not our system. If you wanted us to be represented in the United States government, I don't mean being a part of it, but to be represented, then we would have diplomatic relations with the United States, and we don't. I mean, I know Obama and I think you know, Biden's done the same thing where they have this indigenous summit or tribal summit or what do they call it, and it's right around, you know, Thanksgiving time, so it's the run up to Christmas, and yeah, and Native governments send their elected officials or their federally recognized officials, federally recognized, mind you, because otherwise they wouldn't be allowed to go to the White House, and they pose for pictures in front of the Christmas tree, and you know, and they and the president does a flyby essentially, or walk by really, but a flyby. And some, you know, conversations exist amongst staffers, but it's not a summit. There's no real discussion on what Native people need or expect from the federal government. And I don't mean in terms of charity. I just mean in terms of relationship. It never happens. And having Native people serve in Congress or the Senate or a cabinet secretary doesn't necessarily mean that we now have representation. I go back to, you know, I remember when Mitch McConnell once tried to address the issue of reparations for descendants of slaves. And he said, what do you mean reparations? You had a black president. That was your reparations. I mean, he literally tried to reduce all of the American racist history towards, you know, towards Africans and black people here in the United States to have resolved because Barack Obama was elected president. Like, okay, there, we gave you your fix. Well, that struck a note with me because I knew at some point we were going to have that same kind of thing said about us. And now Deb Haaland sits there as the cabinet secretary, the Secretary of the Interior, and there are probably people thinking the same thing. Well, Native people got something now. No, we didn't. She got something. She got a job. She got a job. She got hired by Joe Biden. And you know who she represents there? Joe Biden. It doesn't matter what her background is. It doesn't matter how Native she looks or where she comes from. Look, she was elected to Congress as well, predominantly by white people. And she served the congressional district that elected her. And there were some Native people in there. But they weren't anywhere near the majority of her constituency. And so she walked that party line. She navigated through that Democratic Party apparatus, managed to keep her nose clean, have very little, you know, controversy associated with her. And look, she did work for Laguna Pueblo. I think she worked for their gaming operations. And she didn't make too many waves there, even though there was some contentious issues over things like revenue sharing when she was working there. But she didn't, you know, take a hard line. Yeah, I know, she went to Standing Rock. Well, lots of people went to Standing Rock. And they went and they came back and they said, well, I went to Standing Rock. I mean, it's not like they were on the front line getting gassed in the face or, you know, or hit with water cannons or anything like that. So, you know, look, I think some people consider taking the trip to Standing Rock as some sort of rite of passage about being Native. Well, let me just say right now, I didn't go to Standing Rock. I know plenty of people who did. But I felt like there was more that I could do here than being one of 10,000 people, you know, trying to, you know, get the I was at Standing Rock T-shirt or whatever else. But anyway, so I mentioned that, and my conversation about Native people being in these positions will connect up a little bit to what the next part of what I want to talk about, because one of the things that is starting to get a little bit of attention. Was the previous Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, who is now running for Congress. And so some of his dirty laundry is cropping up. And there's been some question about, you know, the possible corruption involved in his Interior, you know, department. You know, among the things that people are pretty well aware of is that his Interior Department essentially canceled, or actually didn't even cancel. They didn't. They just buried the effort by two Native peoples, groups of Native peoples in Massachusetts, to opening up gaming facilities. And he didn't decline them. He didn't reject them, so they would have a proper recourse to do something about it. They just buried it, and so just kept those people in no man's land, in limbo. And so now what's coming out is, well, you know, there was a lot of lobbying going on, and, you know, we understand that Zinke may have met with gaming lobbyists who were against this and that kind of stuff. Let's be clear. Ryan Zinke worked for Donald Trump. Donald Trump had major issues with native people involved in gaming. He blamed his failure as a casino mogul, it's almost funny to call him that, on the fact that native people had some unfair advantage over him. Now, other casinos were able to make money, but not Donald Trump. So he blamed it, and he actually testified before Congress. Now, again, I just got to say this. You got a guy who wears more makeup and, you know, and has more hair work than the average drag queen. He goes before Congress and starts saying that the native people who are doing gaming in Connecticut, for instance, don't look Indian to him. So he's talking about appearance. Now, here's a guy who's been fudging his own appearance forever, and he literally has the gall to say, well, they don't look Indian to me. That's it. That's his line. So, I mean, look, this guy clearly had plenty of animus towards Native people in general. And look, he cheated a bunch of Native people in along the lines and that kind of stuff. But it is – you can't separate the position that Donald Trump had towards Native gaming and Ryan Zinke. So – to suggest that Zinke was corrupt, I'm not saying he wasn't corrupt, but he was serving at the pleasure of the President of the United States. And it's pretty clear what the President of the United States' view was towards Native gaming. Now, another little-known fact, and I haven't even brought it up here before, so, and in spite of me talking a lot about Seneca gaming, you know, during the Trump administration, the Senecas were already in the throes of a major controversy and conflict with New York State over revenue sharing, which is supposed to be based on the state providing some concession that they get some, you know, revenue shared with them in return, and the Senecas never viewed they were getting a fair shake. Well, the Interior Department, the Obama Interior Department, Sally Jewell, I think, might have been the cabinet secretary at the time, but that Interior Department, or Bureau of Indian Affairs, as a part of that Interior Department, had actually issued an opinion about the Seneca gaming revenue sharing with New York State, and pretty much lambasted New York State and the failure of New York State to have made an adequate concession for the ungodly amounts of money they were receiving. The Trump administration, with Ryan Zinke, they withdrew that opinion. So the Senecas were going to use this. And in fact, that letter from the Interior Department, which was justified, was part of the legal argument that the Senecas were making. They had to withdraw that part of their evidence because of Ryan Zinke, Donald Trump, the Trump administration. So, yeah, again, even if Ryan Zinke was serving at the pleasure of the president, I don't think he should be let off the hook. And if somebody wants to raise this issue about, you know, this level of corruption, or let's not call it corruption, let's call it what it is, racism. If somebody wants to raise the question about this level of racism for a guy who actually served in the Interior Department, which was one of the tasks of the Interior Department is to fulfill the trust obligation that the United States is supposed to have towards Native people. And yet, some of his actions were overtly racist towards Native people. So should he be held accountable for that as he runs for Congress? Oh, hell yes, he should be. But I just don't want people to forget. I did an interview this week, and somebody said, well, to find corruption in the Trump administration is a little bit like shooting fish in a barrel. Well, that's true. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't point it out when it's there. We shouldn't shine a light on it, even if there's an awful lot of lights to shine. And Ryan Zinke in the Interior Department, clearly there was a significant level of racism that came into play, and this was racism that Donald Trump harbored since his failure at running casinos. I mean, he loathed the fact that Native people could do gaming, and in many ways do gaming in places that or in a manner that states or private gaming companies like his, you know, couldn't do, and it just really pissed him off. And that's why he was so hateful towards Native people, and always has been. So, you know, for all the stuff that people are trying to hold Trump accountable for, this is, you know, just one in a long list. But, you know, Trump may or may not be running again in the next election, but Ryan Zinke sure is, and he, you know, he should be called out for it. Now, and, you know, and this kind of brings me to the current Interior Secretary. So, for anybody to suggest, just like with these three Native or six Native Congress persons, that somehow now Native people are going to be well served by the Interior Department because Deb Haaland is in there. Again, let me say, we didn't put her there. The white guy in the White House did. And that's who she serves. Now, I'm not saying that she's not going to do any good work. I'm not saying that. But to suggest that somehow we're going to get special deference from her because she's Native? I mean, I remember when Diane Humatiwa, who is a federal judge, she was actually nominated by Obama, but the recommendations came from the two Arizona senators, Flake and McCain. So she was a Republican suggestion. She was pushed forward by the Republicans. And I don't know if Obama, because she was a person of color, felt like he was going to, you know, get some brownie points for that. No pun intended on the brownie points. But so Diane Humatiwa she ended up getting a position as a federal judge. In her first case that involved Native people, which had to do with a highway that was being run through ancestral Native lands, and the Native people are saying, look, we've got all kinds of artifacts and, you know, archaeological pieces that are there, and this should not run through there. They shouldn't put this interstate highway through our through our lands. And she ruled against Native people. You know, and in many ways, sometimes having a Native person who is in one of these positions can be advantageous to us, because now they're under this microscope that if they rule in favor of Native people, that they're not being, you know, unbiased, that they're making the ruling based on their own, you know, personal feelings or ethnicities. So it doesn't work in our favor to have a Native person there. I mean, you would think, well, at least she would understand the issues more. No, it doesn't matter. You know, she didn't make a ruling that gave any, I don't want to say special, but any consideration at all to the Native connection that we have, the Native people have to the lands. No, that was not even part of her consideration. So, again, I have to remind people that when we jump into that canoe, and that's why we have this thing called the two-row wampum, and what we say is that we're on two paths on the river of life, meaning Native people and non-Native people, and we're going to experience some of the same things on that path. Or in one of the ways that the two-row wampum got reinterpreted was because white folks didn't have a path on our lands. They came by boat. So what we talked about was two vessels running side by side down the river of life. So we used water as the analogy after white people got here, because they didn't have any path worn by ancestors on our lands. All they had was the direction of their boat was traveling and the wake caused by the boat. So what we said is, look, on this river of life, we're going to experience some of the same, problems. We're going to weather, whatever, rough waters. And there may come times that we help each other, but we're not going to overtake each other. We're not going to ride in your vessel. You're not going to ride in our vessel. We're not going to steer your vessel. You're not going to steer our vessel. So, and that was the relationship that Native people, and this was, a Haudenosaunee thing, but Haudenosaunee had the same relationship with many other peoples before white people showed up here. And so other Native cultures adopted that same principle of a two-row wampum. And that was a belt that we manufactured to say this represents peaceful coexistence. Well, there hasn't been much peaceful coexistence, and we have been under a constant barrage of genocide at worst, assimilation, which is genocide, a kinder, gentler genocide, at best. Today, you know, we have to have a 15-20 minute conversation about whether we are or are not Americans, U.S. citizens or Canadian citizens. For us to even have that conversation is very problematic, especially for elected officials. You know, we have our own governments, right? You would think, okay, if only Native people can vote in their native elections, and some are elections and some are, you know, traditional governments that have various apparatuses and processes and procedures for determining leadership. But if only Native people can be a part of that, why should we be a part of white people's governments? And of course, there's a reason for that, because this is the effort to assimilate us. And what better examples of assimilation is not only us participating in their elections, but running in them. So, look, I'm not calling Sharice Davids or Kai Gahele or Mary Peltola. I'm not calling them traitors. They jumped in the other ship, that's all. And I'm not saying they lost their skin tone or the memories, but they don't necessarily have the connection, because they serve a different master. They're serving a different people. They're serving the Americans under the U.S. Constitution. Wherever their hearts are and their minds are as it relates to their indigeneity, that's not what got them into these positions. Not Deb Haaland. You know, and I would say the same thing for any person of a distinct culture who strives to have success in this dominant culture that is pretty much still very white dominated. I mean, you don't need much of a color chart when you're looking at the seats of Congress. Yeah, and you sure don't need much of a color chart, you know, any place else. You know, look, we look at the court system, and I get it. I know there's plenty of black judges. Well, I don't know if there's enough, but there are many black judges, and there's some Hispanic judges, and even the Supreme Court has, you know, Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Jackson and Clarence Thomas. And, you know, so, yeah, I get it. I mean, there are people of color there, but they didn't get there because they were fighting for civil rights. They may have been representing some positions of law, you know, within the judicial system, and didn't do anything too controversial to get there. But that doesn't mean they're going to go out on a limb for us, or even necessarily. I mean, look, I think about somebody like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Jewish woman on the court. She was considered the liberal darling, and I know I've mentioned this many times on my show, but she cited the doctrine of Christian discovery as footnote number one in her ruling against Oneidas, who purchased land back, saying, no, you can't do that. You can purchase it, but it's still going to be a U.S. deed. It's going to be a state deed. You can't reclaim your land. And that's the position she took. In spite of being Jewish and whatever her ties to Israel and, you know, and Jewish resettlement and everything else, you know, people still want to claim her, you know, that she was, you know, the badass, right, of the court. Well, she didn't do that much for us. You know, she may have lamented about it later in her book, but that didn't change anything. So I have to remind people that the Native experience is one that has challenges all over the place. And when people try to suggest, well, what some of the solutions are going to be, which is to somehow assimilate us, and then to characterize those of Native descent, those of us who are going to earn the banner of being successful, are always going to be the people who are the most assimilated, served in the military, go to church, line up with one party or the other, political party, and find their way through those party apparatuses to gain success there. And again, I'm not even condemning it. But Charisse Davids is a congresswoman out of Kansas. She doesn't represent me. Kahele, he's a congressman for Hawaii. I can't honestly say that it represents the Hawaiian Kingdom movement. I don't know how you could possibly suggest that. And Mary Peltola, look, these all may be really nice people. And I haven't heard anything terrible, about any of these people. And I'm not judging as human beings. But, man, I just can't tolerate this notion that because of their native ancestry, that anyone would suggest, least of all them, that because they got elected, predominantly by white people, that now there's indigenous representation in Congress. No, that's not the way it works. You give up a certain amount of your responsibility to your own people. When you start trying to expand your constituency to volumes and volumes of white people. I hope they do right by us while they're in those positions. But you know what? There's three Democratic Congress people who have Native backgrounds, and there's three Republicans. I don't see the six of them lining up to push forward some major reform on the part of the federal government as it relates to our relationship with them. I've talked about residential schools, and I haven't heard a word out of the Republican congressman, by the way, but you hear platitudes offered up by Democrats about dealing with the residential schools. But if we're not talking about restoration of both the lands, some of the lands anyway, that were lost during 150 years of residential schools, and our autonomy, our distinction, our identity, how can we have to talk about reconciliation? Reconciliation is a paycheck. Anytime people talk about reconciliation, we're gonna write a check. We're gonna authorize funding. It may be funding for a program, but it's still all about money. And I'm not suggesting that restoration of lands isn't going to cost something, too. But you know what? What would restoration of our autonomy cost? I mean, would it really be costly? I mean, or would that level of independence and autonomy and distinction be something that we can use to drive our own successes? That's where I'm at. I say, look, the more we can market, if you will, again, we're talking money, our regulatory advantages, our distinctions, as we enter into businesses. Look, let me take a little bit of a walk down memory lane here. 40, 50 years ago, most white folks or non-Native people wouldn't even go on Native lands. It was considered unsafe. Oh, you don't want to go to the reservation. You don't know what they'll do to you there. I mean, there was this taboo. And, and anybody who did go, there was always some question. Well, yeah, what made you go there? Why would you go on their land? Well, so what happens is we start taking an interest in becoming entrepreneurs on our lands. I mean, because up to that point, we had to go off our territories to find jobs. And of course, that would turn into sometimes tax fights and that kind of stuff. One of the more successful areas that Native men got involved in was the construction trades. And of course, many people know, if you're from New York City, Mohawks and High Steel, the Mohawks who walked built those skyscrapers. And it was, it's one of the famed skill sets that Native men, not just Mohawks, but Native men had. So we had to place our life in peril to build these monuments to white progress, those shining cities on the hill, and then earn income and bring it back to, pretty desolate and impoverished Native territories. Well, at some point, we decided we're going to open businesses. And I talked about this a little bit last week when I talked about 40 years and we're still fighting New York State over tobacco. Well, that was one of the areas that we started. We started opening up smoke shops. What people don't realize is that beyond the money that was generated and the income and the commerce stream that was, you know, that was built based on us just selling one product, cigarettes, it began to change the dynamic. Because now we were asking people to come onto our lands. We're asking the non-native public to come onto our lands. And little by little, it started changing people's perceptions of us. Now, I'm not saying everybody. Look, we didn't eradicate racism by selling cigarettes. No, but we certainly opened up a different dialogue. Relationships got formed. Both, some of them were associated with business, but some of it was just the commerce, the trade. You know, see, having a regular customer come into a shop. We expanded those into gas stations and convenience stores, so we had more flows of non-native people coming onto our territories. Like I said, over the course of just a couple of decades, there was such a dramatic change in how we interacted with the people around us. Because not only did white people not want to come on our lands, we didn't want to go into their communities. I mean, there were essentially unwritten sit-down laws. If you were a native kid and you were seen in the village outside your territory, the white community, you had a great chance of getting picked up by the cops, I mean, and arrested for something. So it changed. Now, it didn't change everywhere because, look, when I'm talking about some of these territories that I'm familiar with here in Seneca Territory or Mohawk Territory or whatever, Onondaga, Tuscarora, we have a fairly substantial non-native population around us. Now, native territories that were really, really remote, and our territories are fairly remote. I mean, it's not like we didn't have a bustling, intersections in any of our territories, but we were close enough to Rochester or Syracuse or Buffalo, and so we're in an area that had a fair amount of, people who had mobility, who could move around and shop. Other places, not so much. And some of those places still have major divisions and major, almost antagonistic relationships with the non-native public around them. I mean, it was only a few years ago we saw, a guy in, I think it was Little Falls, Montana, dumping beer on kids who had gone to a semi-pro hockey game. So the white guy just thought it was fun to dump his beer from his luxury suite, his luxury box, onto the little kids who were rewarded because of their school performance by going to a hockey game. We still have some of that here, but you kind of got to get out a little farther than the immediate relationships that we've built up over the last, 40 years. But I don't think people understand how much this has transformed. And you can see this in places like Long Island, too, the two native communities down there as well, Pusputuk and Shinnecock. But no, so things have changed. Now, I'm not saying there aren't tensions. Obviously, the Shinnecock had all kinds of tensions going on over just putting a sign up on their lands. But, I think it's worth noting that for the downsides that there are, and there are downsides in selling cigarettes, obviously, and some of the, doing gaming and that kind of stuff, there were some upsides. And some of the upsides had to do with changing that perception. Now, I won't say that the change of perception was all good, because now we got stereotyped as owning, all Native people own casinos, or all Native people have smoke shops, and they're all millionaires by selling, merchants of or products of death in terms of cigarettes, and so there was also a negative side of how that perception changed as we became a little bit more interactive with the non-Native public around us, and of course, being in those businesses never really resolved the political tensions. If anything, they made them worse. And I'm not just talking about the governor of the state of New York, we've had tensions with politicians across the states on everything from taxes to land use to distribution. So we still have a lot of tensions that never get resolved. Like I said, 40 years, and we're still fighting New York State over our involvement in a tobacco business that essentially, again, I remind you, tobacco was ours. It kind of got hijacked and got turned into something that we never used it for, but it became this very, very commercial product that, this multi-billion dollar industry, global industry. And then we clawed back and grabbed a little piece of it. And we get put under a microscope for it. And we fight, to the tune of millions and millions of dollars on a yearly basis to stay in that game so we can have something that bolsters our private sector. But you know what? You're not going to see indigenous Congress people push through any reform to protect our businesses or to acknowledge that beyond gas, gaming, and cigarettes, there are other businesses that we should be able to get involved in that capitalize on our regulatory advantages. No, most people in political office want to fight us on any angle we might have that allows us to capitalize on some advantage. Because look, first and foremost, we're disadvantaged. We've been shoved off into out-of-the-way places, away from major thoroughfares, away from major populations. We're fortunate enough, here, like where I live here in Seneca Territory, not to be too far away from some fairly affluent white folks. And I'm not saying it's always a good thing, but we're not that far away. We're not hundreds of miles away. But in spite of that fact, we still get a treatment that is second rate. There was recent news about how much the life expectancy of Native people diminished compared to life expectancy of white people. And yes, life expectancy across the United States has dropped. But it's almost dropped double for Native people as opposed to white people. And, a lot of this is COVID related. Why is that? Because we were hit harder by COVID than anywhere. Why would that be? We're not really an unhealthier population. Well, it's a funny thing what poverty will do. And most Native people are living in some form of abject poverty, whether it's in Hopi Navajo territory or whether it's Lakota territory or whether it's here on Seneca territory. Yeah, there's gaming dollars here, and they do offset some of it. But we don't have adequate health care. I mean, the Indian Health Services, they pass the buck to the states. In order for me to get service at the clinic at Seneca Nation, I have to apply for Medicare. Because Indian Health Service don't pay the bills until every other alternative has been exhausted. So the states get an unfair burden placed on them as it relates to our health care. Our health care was promised. How do you think you got all this land from us? Health, education, and welfare. We get substandard education. We get substandard health care. And the welfare that's meant by that expression is not placing us on social services. We shouldn't be in America's safety net. This isn't charity. This is a bill that's owed. This is a debt that the United States owes to us because they've occupied 95% of our lands, 99% of our lands. And they did it through very nefarious means, including 150 years of residential schools. So I bring some of this stuff up because I know the general population doesn't understand these issues. And as I do this show in for New York City and for Washington, D.C., look, these are two major markets for my messaging to reach out to. And I hope and I expect that Native people listen to this program, but I very much expect non-Native people to listen to it because I'm in the radio in two cities. And whether you agree with everything that I say, which is fine if you don't, but you do have to understand that some of what I'm saying is really factual. It's not just opinion. And so if you want to disagree with facts, well, that's on you. If you want to disagree with opinions, okay, we can have that conversation. But, you know, part of, again, and I realize I didn't do this at the beginning of the show, so please allow me to do it now, but it is so important to have space on WBAI in New York City and on WPFW in Washington, D.C. So if you're listening to the program, I'm going to take a break just before I hit my final topic here. I want to remind people that we are listener-supported radio, and we need your support to stay on the air. And I say I need it, but the stations need your support, because I don't get any of the donations, any of the contributions, any of the sponsorships that you guys send in to WBAI and WPFW. It doesn't come to me. In fact, the vast majority of producers on these stations are volunteers. And there are some paid staff to help us, you know, guys like Reggie and Michael G and others who help us get on the, we have people that have to do a job here. But we need your support. So if you're listening in New York City, please go to the pledge line. It's 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or go online to give2wbai.org. And look, I hope some of you will be generous. You know, I don't think I've gotten a whole $1,000 donations for my segments on here, but I'd like some. But I'd also like to, I used to have a pretty good list of WBAI buddies who signed up during my program. And I'd like to build that back up. So again, if you go online, give2wbai.org, you can follow the prompts, you can make a one-time donation, a substantial donation, you can do a modest donation, you can do a time donation. You can also become a sustaining member of the station by becoming a BAI buddy, and you sign up to make a $10 contribution per month or whatever you can afford. And the same thing goes for WPFW. So if you're listening in Washington, D.C., I ask that you go to their pledge line, WPFW's pledge line, which is 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. Or go to their donation page at WPFWDC.org/donate. And same thing goes there. Follow the prompts. You can make a one-time donation, a time donation. There are several ways you can donate to both stations. And if you go online, you can see the manners in which you can make those donations. All right, last thing I got to talk about before I go here. In New York City, there is going to be a parade, and it's scheduled for October 15th. I realize that's not Indigenous Peoples Day. It's the Saturday afterwards, October 15th at 12 p.m. It starts at Madison Square Park, not Madison Square Garden, but Madison Square Park in Manhattan. It's an Indigenous parade to honor the Indigenous Peoples of America. Now, it's the first one. And, you know, these things, you know, take a lot of effort to pull off. Just getting the permit is a huge accomplishment. I mean, getting the commitment from New York City to allow this parade to take place on the streets of Manhattan is quite an accomplishment for the folks who were involved in this. I do plan to have a guest in the couple of days before this event, the Thursday before October 15th. To talk about the details, but do look for it. I'll post some information on my Facebook pages as well. But we haven't done away with those Columbus Day parades yet, but at least we will have this parade. And look, when it comes to Indigenous peoples, these parades not only represent our culture, putting us out there as a celebration for existing, you know, still in a place like New York City. And there's 100,000 Native people that live in New York City at any given time. And I don't know that we're going to have 100,000 people show up for this parade, but I'm hoping an event like this can bring Native people who are oftentimes very disconnected in a city like New York City together. There's also a climate element. I mean, there was a significant part of our population that was involved in the climate march, which actually the anniversary was just a couple of days ago of the climate march in New York City. We led the charge. We led the front of that parade. And I thank the folks at WBAI for allowing me to sit with Mimi Rosenberg and cover that event up by, ironically, Columbus Circle. So this is it. This is our first ever Indigenous Peoples Parade in New York City. Not even sure what to expect. I'm hoping for the best and acknowledging that these things take an awful lot of planning and an awful lot of participation. So I'm hoping it's well attended, and I hope that you come out. I hope if you're in the city on the weekend, that on October 15th you'll head down to Manhattan, head down to Madison Square Park, and I'm not exactly sure which route they're taking, but that's where they will start off. So if you head down there, you'll get a chance to see. Because, you know, you listen to me on the radio, that doesn't mean you have a whole lot of interaction with Native people. This is an opportunity for the general public to see Native people. And, of course, we will also be celebrating on that Monday, Indigenous Peoples Day, as other people are celebrating that other holiday. I know Randall's Island usually hosts events out there, and although I can't confirm that that's happening this year, look for it. Look for what's happening in New York City for Indigenous Peoples Day, and be reminded that this parade will take place in on the Saturday, the 15th. And again, I'll have some guests joining me in a couple of weeks to talk about it. But so this is there are a lot of people excited about this, and there are Native people who live in the area, the Ramapo in particular. I know my good friend Michael G. Haskins went out to Ramapo territory, the Lenape territory, for some of their events, and there are Native people who live in the area, not just Long Island, but all of New York City was once Indigenous land, so many of us claim it still is. So hopefully this parade will bring a lot of people out, a lot of people together, and it won't be... It's not going to be Native people in a fishbowl. It's going to be an opportunity for non-Native people to interact and mingle, and hopefully learn something on that given day as well. So I want to, I'll thank people in advance for marking this down on their calendars and making an attempt to go see this. I'm not sure that I'll make it. I may, but for those of you who don't know, I do my program, this program, from the Cattaraugus Territory of the Seneca Nation. I'm grateful again that WPFW and WBAI air the program and allow me to do the show remotely. I really do miss coming to New York, and I used to come every week to do this. And it's been since COVID that WPFW picked up the program. So I'm really hoping, I'm looking forward to at some point making the trip to Washington to do a couple of in-studio shows, and making the trip back to New York to do some programs. But you know what? In order to do that, it requires you to keep us on the air. So, again, I ask that you go to the pledge lines for WPFW and WBAI. Go to the websites for WPFW and WBAI and make your contributions. Keep these stations going. And, you know, I know oftentimes, you know, we have to oversell this idea of being listener-supported radio, because that's what we are. We don't have commercials. We don't have corporate sponsors. I mean, it's ironic, even when you listen to NPR and you hear that the Koch brothers and Facebook and Twitter and all these major contributors are paying for the programming on NPR. It's somehow, to me, in spite of all the money, it cheapens it. And, you know, for us, we're running on shoestring budgets most of the time, and we're always in a little bit of a game of catch up. But you can make the difference by contributing to these stations. So please do. I'll run them off real quick one more time. If you're in New York City, the pledge line is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. The website is give2wbai.org. If you are listening and want to support us in Washington, D.C., the pledge line is 202-588-9739. That's 202 588-9739. And the website is wpfwdc.org/donate. Look, this program goes up as a podcast as well, so you can look for it. If you ask your smart speaker to play Resistance Radio with John Cain, it will come up. You'll can hear the latest programs, and it'll keep playing them as long as you want to listen. And so I appreciate those of you who check us out as a podcast. Of course, if you go to the station's archives, you can hear the program as well. I also have to tell people I do another podcast called Let's Talk Native, which was my original show. And that podcast comes out, once every couple of weeks, maybe once a month, depending on the topic. And you can find that by asking your smart speaker or Google searching Let's Talk Native with John Cain, and you can listen to that program as well. I want to thank you for joining me. I want to thank you for giving me your attention and your time and the space in your lives. And again, it's a pleasure to be a part of these two radio stations and to be a part of your afternoons. I'm John Cain, and this is Resistance Radio. Yahweh.
From WPFW in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Thursday, September 22nd. Here are some headlines. A judge in Indiana today temporarily blocked a near-total abortion ban in the state that had been in effect for a week. As of today, abortion in Indiana is legal up until the 22nd week of pregnancy. Owen County Judge Kelsey Hanlon sided with the plaintiffs in the case, who argued that the ban violated the Indiana's Constitution's right to privacy and equal privileges protections. Hanlon wrote in the court's opinion that, quote, there is a reasonable likelihood that decisions about family planning, including decisions about whether to carry a pregnancy to term, are included in the state's constitution, close quote. Indiana state officials are likely to appeal the ruling, and they can request that the preliminary injunction on the law be stopped while the appeal plays out. If that happens, it is possible that the law will become active again while the legal challenge continues. The U.S. Treasury Department today announced sanctions against Iran's so-called morality police over the death of a woman in custody and violence against protesters. 22-year-old Mahsa Amini was detained by the police in Tehran for her improper hijab and died days later. Protests over her death have morphed into widespread dissent against the regime. Amnesty International said security forces have used batons, birdshot, tear gas, and water cannons to disperse protesters and reported 8 deaths linked to the unrest, including 4 people killed by security forces. The police say Mahsa Amini died of a heart attack and was not mistreated, but her family has cast doubt on that account and said she had no pre-existing heart condition. The United Nations called for an impartial inquiry into her death. A Minnesota judge on Wednesday sentenced former Minneapolis police officer Thomas Lane to 3 years in prison for his role in the 2020 killing of George Floyd while he was in police custody. Lane, already serving a 2.5-year federal sentencing for violating Floyd's civil rights, will serve the new sentence on the state charge aiding and abetting second-degree manslaughter concurrently. Judge Peter Cahill accepted the plea agreement between Lane and prosecutors, which included a recommended sentence below sentencing guidelines because Lane had accepted responsibility. Lane, who is white, held down Floyd's legs while Officer Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck as the unarmed black man pleaded for air. New York Attorney General Letitia James on Wednesday accused former President Donald Trump of massive fraud in a civil lawsuit following a 3-year inquiry into the finances of Trump's family business. The lawsuit accuses Trump, 3 of his adult children, and the Trump Organization of flagrantly